And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast on midday Thursday, where Adrian Wojnarowski just reported the NBA season will resume after a truly momentous 24, 48 hours in not just sports, but American history, centering around the protest of and anguish over the shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin, by a police officer who is yet to be fired. And chronicling all of it, centering on the Milwaukee Bucks, who sat out their game against the Orlando Magic. It was to be game five of the Eastern Conference first round. In Orlando, she's been there from the beginning. Malika Andrews, how are you?
I'm tired, Zach, but I'm hanging in. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I wonder, as you were standing outside the locker room, waiting for the Bucks, realizing that something unusual was going to happen, and then waiting and waiting, you're a reporter, so part of you is like, this is a story. I got to get the story. But I wonder what you felt as a human being. Could you step outside the, I got to get the scoop. There's the video guy. Let me see if I can get a quote from him. Could you step outside that and digest what was happening on like a broader human being level?
I don't think I really could digest it until last night. I think that in the moment, as I was standing there, it was sort of like, I'm looking at my phone battery. Do I have enough battery to make it through however long they're going to be in there? Do I have time to go to use the facilities, or do I need to stand here? But it did strike me in the moment as I am getting the opportunity to cover history, and not just sports history, not just a record breaking amount of three pointers in a game, but a moment that really felt like it could be a turning point or had the potential to be in America, in the United States, in American sports, in the world, in politics. And I don't think it was till I came back last night to my hotel room after a really long day that I let myself go there in a way, because I think that I tried so hard to focus on the players and telling their stories and not making it about myself. But it's hard not to feel that gravity, especially because sometimes I feel torn. Like, a lot of the things that these players are talking about as a Black person are also things that I feel. I remember there was a point where I was sitting in my apartment in New York, and I was watching protests go by outside my window, huge protests, thousands of people. In the wake of George Floyd. And I was sitting in my New York apartment a couple months ago now, and I was looking out the window, and I would open the window and stick my head out so that I could take in all the protesters that were coming. And a part of me felt really guilty that I was able to, coronavirus was a real thing. And being a journalist, I didn't want to compromise my impartiality there. But there was a part of me that felt guilty that I didn't have to be out there for the sake of my livelihood, because for whatever reason, I am a Black person that makes white people feel comfortable enough. I feel like I can approach cops and I can operate in these spheres that some people, just because of they look like me, don't have the privilege of doing. And so balancing that and that weight, I think that's similar in some ways to what the players are feeling being here, because they talk about just being another Black man when they step off of the court, which I believe is true. And they also have the ability, there is no status or wealth or money that can buy your way out of racism or being racially targeted or discriminated against. And I do believe that there is a privilege that affords you that you can choose to use in a certain way. And so that's what these players are grappling with here. And so it really wasn't until I came back to my hotel room last night that I kind of started to think more big picture about those sorts of things and where all of those things fit and how they feel about being entertainers and also Black men, and what responsibility they have in all of this that they put on themselves, and to be there chronicling that is and was really special.
Well, and what you said, one of the many points you just made, reminded me of how moved I felt that after the Bucks came out of the locker room, one of the two people that they decided to read the statement that they wrote for them was Sterling Brown. Yep. And Sterling Brown has faded into the background, right? He doesn't play for the Bucks anymore, although I thought Bud should have been playing him earlier in the year, but that's not really relevant anymore. His story, as many legal stories do, has just kind of taken a long time. I believe the civil case he has filed against the state or the city, I can't remember which entity, is still ongoing. He rejected a $400,000 settlement. And for people who don't know, Sterling Brown was tasered and knelt upon by seven police officers for the crime of parking in a handicapped spot for a minute going into a Walmart at 2 a.m. in Milwaukee. And people might want to say, well, you know, Sterling Brown, he's the 12th man on the Bucks. You know, someone above him, Chris Middleton, Giannis, could buy their way out of this. These things don't apply to those players. But Sterling Brown's one of 12 guys on the Milwaukee Bucks. He's one of 12 guys on a small market basketball team. He's a celebrity. He's a big deal. Maurice Harkless, who posted that story yesterday about getting pulled over in Portland with two teenage kids in the car, he plays for the Portland Trailblazers. Anybody who plays for the Portland Trailblazers is a big deal. These famous people, rich people, are not inoculated from any of this.
No, there is no exception. And that's the point. That's why we saw Jimmy Butler earlier when the bubble was resuming say, hey, can I not have a name on the back of my jersey? The point that he was trying to make is when I do not have a basketball in my hand, I am perceived the way that any other Black person might be perceived. When I'm walking around at night when I have my hoodie on, or maybe in broad daylight when I don't have my hoodie on, I am going to be Masai Ujiri walking around in his suit in the Golden State Warriors arena. The point is, it doesn't matter. There is no certain wealth status or celebrity status you can get to where you can just check racism off and say, hey, this is no longer going to be an issue for me because I've achieved X. And that's the point that players continue to go back to. They say, we are players. We are Black men that are players.
That reminds me, you know, we were on The Jump together yesterday and you brought up that you think players there are feeling something of survivor's guilt. Could you elaborate on that a little bit? I mean, you've talked to a lot of players there. You've been there the whole time.
Yeah. When you are able to become a professional basketball player, and that takes skill and dedication and hard work and time, there is inevitably another talented person on your block, your AAU team, your high school team, your middle school team, whatever, that was in many ways equally as talented or at least had potential that you also saw, but for whatever reason, and some people may say it was the time or the energy, that person didn't get the same opportunity to quote unquote get out that these basketball players that we see in the NBA did. And that sense of responsibility for players of asking themselves, why me? One is not just reserved for successful Black players. There's many successful Black people in many different professions that struggle with that. But that's something that's come up. Why is it that we were afforded, players are thinking, this ability to be able to quote unquote get out of this situation? And if we hadn't, what would our lives be like? And because we were able to move into the limelight, into fame, into wealth, there is a feeling amongst some of these players, not every day, but at many points throughout a week or a month or a year, that they sit there and think, what is my responsibility to give back or to do something for the person that could have been me? Because for whatever reason, I was able to be the one. And we've heard guys say this before coming to the bubble. We've heard LeBron James talking about being just another kid from Akron. And what he's saying there in many ways is that there are a bunch of LeBron Jameses who never got the opportunity I did. So why me? And then the added pressure in this moment is, what responsibility do I have to those people to help them? And I thought Mark Spears made a really powerful point in a conversation we had last night. He said, I don't think that sometimes these players can see the impact that they're having in the outside world because change takes time. And in a short period of time, they've been able to convince owners to donate $300 million to causes that they believe in that can help Black and brown people. They have had different organizations hire more people of color. All of those things are meaningful, but because these players put that weight on them, they are seeking something bigger and more because that question prevails. Why me? Why did I get this opportunity? And what do I need to do to make sure somebody else does?
Yeah, there were a number of reasons why the what are they hoping to accomplish by doing this dialogue bothered me overnight and this morning. And I fear that dialogue is only going to get louder because they're coming back to play perhaps as early as tomorrow. And people will say, well, what is the point? What have they accomplished? Well, first of all, to your point, a $300 billion fund that I would be surprised if it's not beefed up a little bit after this, because the players have realized the power and the leverage they have. Another team, the Houston Rockets, today became, I think, the fifth or sixth team to open their arena as a polling center for the 2020 presidential election. Their governor, Tillman Fertitta, has not exactly, let's say, been hostile to President Trump, who is in turn seen as hostile and antithetical to the values of almost every player in the NBA. To get him to do that, to have him do that, is a big deal. And there will be more. There will be more. For the Bucks to get on the phone with top officials in the state of Wisconsin and demand accountability in the case of Jacob Blake, yeah, the accountability didn't come when they hung up the phone. That's not how it works. That's not how the justice process works. For them to get that conversation is a big deal, and they'll have more conversations, and there will be localized versions of that. All of that said, I think actually the symbolism is important. I think the act by itself of refusing to play a basketball game for the first time in the history of the NBA. We can talk about the 1964 All-Star game. I'm going to talk about that with Bill Roden after this. I just think the mere act matters for a number of reasons, but I'm curious to hear your take on that. But also, like, I don't know if you've run into players overnight, if you've run into players this morning, their take on the whole idea of, like, what is the dialogue you can hear of? What have they accomplished? What have you heard on that in general?
So I think that players feel that. I do believe you're right. There is a group of whatever tweeters who are saying, well, what are you going to do with this time? That we can just set aside. It's that the players, the Milwaukee Bucks specifically, during those 2.5+ hours they were in the locker room yesterday, they made it very clear that what they wanted to spend that time doing was something tangible, something that they could say, this is what we are trying to accomplish, because that makes us feel some sort of sense of accomplishment that we haven't felt in terms of our pursuit of justice in this moment. And the Milwaukee Bucks very well may be successful in effecting some sort of change, whatever that may be, locally in either the city of Milwaukee, the state of Wisconsin, whatever that may be. The players that I've talked to feel that it's very important, not necessarily to answer that question to the outside world of, well, I'm going to justify that this is what we are doing. It's more so that they have felt a void over the last couple of days since the video of Jacob Blake shooting came to light and started circulating the internet. They felt this void of whatever we've done so far isn't enough. So from talking to players, it seems to me that they're trying to answer this question of what can we do that may start to feel like it is enough to affect a little bit more change than we're seeing right now. And they understand that change takes time. It's not rapid, but we're also talking about a generation of people who are fed up, are tired, and understandably so. So I think that the only importance of how are they going to use this time, the symbolism by itself is important. That's only important because the players say it's important for them to feel like they are being productive and helping out, as opposed to just virtue signaling, which I don't think they were doing, but that's what they want to avoid.
So I also, I'm a white man. I can't relate on a visceral level, I can't relate to what black people, not just black men, black people feel when they see these videos, and how it feels to be a black player in a league governed by white men, mm-hmm. and in a league where fans in the stadium are mostly white. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking a lot about Andre Iguodala last night, because Andre Iguodala is a top union official. By all accounts I heard from inside the big players meeting, he was a critical voice. You know, mm-hmm. he said something to the effect of, I can't quote him directly, I wasn't there, but six or seven people told me Andre said something to the effect of, look, guys, if we're gonna cancel the season, we need to go to Wisconsin, we need to go to Kentucky, we need to be on the front lines. Otherwise, what's the point of doing that? You know, we need to be out there. And I heard Maria Taylor today and a couple other people talk about black players sort of this feeling of our bodies are being used to entertain white audiences and how that feels. So I looked up, Andre Iguodala wrote a book called The Sixth Man. It's quite a good book. And Andre is a good writer. And Carvell Wallace wrote it with him as a good writer. He has a passage in there that I wanted to read about how he feels sometimes playing basketball. And he's talking specifically about being at a Utah Jazz game. Here's Andre. You try not to let the discomfort creep into your game, but I defy anyone to be a black person on a floor in shorts and a tank top being screamed at simultaneously by 18,000 white people who are flipping you off and spitting and foaming at the mouth and not feel some deep, primordial, almost cellular sense of threat. It's not possible. It would never be possible, but everything felt much more ominous because this was 2 weeks after Trump had been elected. I was not surprised, Andre continues, by how incredibly and virulently racist this country is. I grew up in Springfield, after all, Illinois. But what did worry me was that I began to wonder how much of my safety was based on the fact that even though people were racist, racism was still socially unacceptable. People were racist, but no one wanted to be called racist. They weren't trying to be out in public about it, which meant that I felt safer in public, he says. But what we had seen over the past year had changed that. There were Nazi rallies and swastikas and people marching in the streets under the Confederate flag. There were murders of black people in churches and on the street, attacks against Muslims. This is the kind of stuff that runs through your head when you are in an arena surrounded by white people who have paid money to express how much they hate you. On the one hand, it's just a game, but on a much deeper level, it can never be. And I wonder, I thought of that passage, which I had highlighted in the book and remembered how powerful it felt to me reading it. Mm-hmm. I just wonder if there is a sense, if you've heard this from players about that feeling and about a stance like this, about sitting out an NBA game, holding a symbolic importance of saying to the fans, you come out and you watch us play. You spend money to watch us play. You cheer, you boo, you build your social calendars around what we do on that court. Guess what? You're either with us. You either believe the anguish and the pain that we feel about this. You either believe that it's real for us. You either take the stances that help these things not happen, that help cure social injustice and racial injustice, or we don't really want to entertain you anymore. Am I reading too deep into it, or is there some sort of symbolic importance on that level?
No, I don't think you're reading too deep into that. I think that that's absolutely correct. And I know that players have been posting as much on social media. They've been saying, if you're not with us now, we don't want you to be with us when we're winning or playing games because you don't support who I am as a fundamental human being. And by the way, Andre Iguodala is right. It isn't an opinion that since this previous election, there has been an uptick in crimes motivated by racial bias and bigotry and hate. That is a fact. In a New York Times article that was published at the end of 2019, the FBI reported that personal attacks motivated, this is a quote, by bias or prejudice reached a 16-year high in 2018, the FBI said on Tuesday, with a significant upswing in violence against Latinos outpacing a drop in assaults targeting Muslims and Arab Americans. So it isn't a feeling that Andre Iguodala just has. It is, but it's also a fact. And these players are coming out and directly saying, be with us now or don't be with us at all.
And I don't know how you can listen to the pain and the anguish. And again, I'm a white kid from the suburbs, now a white guy from the suburbs. I can't relate. I can't feel it. But I don't know how you can listen to the anguish and see it. You don't even have to, you can have it on mute and you can see the anguish. and not have some empathetic bone in your body saying, whoa, even if I haven't, even if I've somehow reached adulthood and I haven't considered the perspective of others, maybe it's time for me to start doing that. And by the way, you know, the Fertitta thing with the Rockets, look, it's no secret. There are some owners in the NBA, some governors rather, who I think there's going to be, I think we're reaching the point where it's the DeVos family can't own the Magic in silence anymore. Not that they own the Magic in silence. Everyone knows they're the governors of the team. But I wonder if we're going to start to see Magic players at some point speak out about where the DeVos family spends its money, what kind of causes they support, how they've been a force on the side of, negative forces in the country. I think that's coming for some of these governors who have been able to sort of sit back and be totally untouched despite having stances that are totally antithetical to the stances of 90 to 100% of NBA players.
Well, and I think that the players, the Milwaukee Bucks said this yesterday in their statement, players have gone over it over and over again. You mentioned opening arenas as places for people to come and vote. LeBron James is launching a voting initiative, or has launched a voting initiative. This election, potentially even more so than the last election or the election before that, is really an opportunity for these players to look at who are, and I know they want to be called governors now, but the term owner is still colloquial and used all the time by players.
I just used it by accident four times.
I mean, I understand trying to change it, but they are owners of the team. That is what they are. They own the team. They pay these players. They pay for this thing to go on. They are owners. And this election is going to be harder to hide behind. It is difficult to be able to justify to these players voting for someone who in many ways passes laws that fundamentally suppress their rights.
And I think LeBron James was among several players in the meeting last night, according to sources, all of whom all of us talked to, who said, you know, something to the effect of, it's time to hold the owners accountable. It's time to make sure that they take action. And I think the players are going to discover the power that they are discovering the power they have. Just simply, imagine if an Orlando Magic player just came out one day and said, by the way, did you guys know that the DeVos family donated to X, Y, and Z and supported piece of legislation X, Y, and Z? And that becomes a public story? That's all it takes. And all of a sudden, we've seen it in the WNBA already with Kelly Loeffler, who they're trying to drive out of the league. And that's become a whole thing. I think that stuff is coming to the NBA. I don't think I mean, whether that's good or bad is up for discussion. I think it personally would be good. I think transparency is good, but I think those discussions are coming. Those confrontations are coming.
Yeah, I do think people will say, well, everyone has the right to their own opinion. And if you want to support, you have the right to donate to whatever cause, left, right, that you would like to contribute to. The question becomes whether there's a place for all of that within this league. And that'll be the question that really players kind of hold the keys to answering.
What did you make on the ground of the level of angst or discomfort there was with how the Bucks kind of decided this on their own at the last minute? How upset or angry or confused were other players, or did they largely just sort of, like Jaylen Brown spoke up in the meeting according to Woj and said, hey, you guys don't have to explain yourselves. We get it.
I think there was just a little bit of a sense of being caught off guard from what I've been told. And from what I have been told from the Bucks side is the intention here wasn't to leave the Magic hanging out to dry on the court. But also from the Magic side, it was, hey, we would be more than willing to step into this space with you, but you didn't give us a chance to. And part of that is just because it came together so quickly, Zach. I mean, I talked to players on the Bucks who arrived at the arena with the intention of playing until they started talking to their teammates who had some other feelings. Players, the Bucks, went and warmed out. They never went out for layup lines, but they went and warmed up for the game. coaches that I have talked to had no idea that this is what was brewing within their locker room. And of course, they supported it once they found out, but there really wasn't this premeditated long discussion about it hours and hours before tip-off. But as we've reported, the message in that players' meeting was just that we've said since we came down here, whatever we are doing, we want to do together. That was the union's message. And so because that isn't what happened, it left a couple of feathers ruffled. I believe that now it seems that that has largely been smoothed over, that, you know, cool heads have prevailed and there just needed to be a night of sitting on it. But there was a sense for a couple of moments that you guys kind of did this without us and we want to be a part of it too. There was no one who disagreed with what the Bucks did. They just wanted to be a part of it.
And I understand the position it puts the Thunder and the Rockets in, you know, who are warming up to play the next game. And every team then begins to think, well, do we want to be the first team to play? Like, that doesn't feel like a good place for us to be. And wait, what's going on? But I also just sort of like, sometimes you just got to do something. Sometimes if you try and plan and get everyone and there's committees and meetings and blah, 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 stuff doesn't happen. Something happened. And then something happened in baseball, in the WNBA, then all across sports. And the discussion of it will continue for a long, long time. And so I just sort of feel like sometimes it takes a sudden decision and commitment and to step one foot further than you thought you were going to. You know what I mean?
I do. And it was also such a sharp turn from the kind of clean, neat, here are the slogans we've approved for you to use, and here is what you can put on the back of your jersey, and here is what is on the court. Because all of that was, and it, I am not downplaying the work it took to get there. That's a big deal. And all of it was negotiated and figured out. And I have been impressed with how authentic it felt yesterday. It just felt like the Bucks had a visceral feeling and they needed to act. And that left me feeling, and many people feeling, more moved than anything else we've seen in the bubble thus far.
Malika, thank you for your time. Thanks for all the work you're doing down in Orlando. It's a long haul. The games apparently will start again, so you'll get some basketball, but this stuff is more important, and I know you're busy, so thank you for making time.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back, and it is my honor and thrill to bring in someone who has done more to cover the intersection of race and sports than probably anybody on earth in the last 40 years. Longtime Sport of the Times columnist at the New York Times, one of my idols growing up, currently at The Undefeated, the author of $40 Million Slaves, among other books, the great William Roden. How are you, sir?
Hey, Zach, thank you so much for all that, man.
Hey, look.
But now, it's really a pleasure being on your show, man. We've done this once before. You've been on mine. Really a great guy, man. You really add a lot of context to the industry. So I really always appreciate, your insight, your remarks. So thank you. You know, thank you. And thank you for having me on the show.
Well, it's a thrill, and it's ridiculous to hear you say that. This has been your, you know, you've written a lot about the intersection of race and sports, and particularly in the NBA over the years. This is an unprecedented or borderline unprecedented event that has happened. The latest is, as we just talked about off air, the games are going to resume either Friday or Saturday after the players voted. I just as someone who's chronicled this, take me through the last 24 hours for you. What have you felt? How are you digesting this? Is it momentous? Is it something less than momentous? Are you almost, or how do you feel about them returning to play?
Yeah. Well, let's start with the beginning. To be honest with you, man, as much as I've written about this, I was a surprise when I heard yesterday that they weren't going to play. I took a double take, and you think, you know, as both, you've been around a long time, you're probably kind of cynical and all that. And frankly, I always thought that this would be the college players just before the Final Four who would pull the plug, you know, and say, hey, we ain't playing until, you know, I thought that might happen. I mean, I thought it never might, but I thought it would. And when I heard that the Bucks did it, you know, I'm like, whoa, really? That's kind of interesting, you know. And so, you know, and for us, man, you know, in our business, this is probably the best time. It's a great time to be a journalist, despite all the terrible stuff that's happening for our business. And, you know, our whole thing is that we go toward the fire when people are moving away from it. I'm like, wow, this is just fascinating. The bubble is the whole idea of the bubbles. Fascinating. You know, none of this stuff has happened before, you know. So when they said that, I was like, wow, it took it to another level. And you know, I thought that although a lot of the guys were and the women were kind of reluctant to leave the battle and the protest to go to the bubble, some made the argument that, well, you know what? We're going to be together. Who knows what kind of mischief we can cause with all of us together. And so I thought that was, I thought it was great, though, strong. You know, the fact that they did not tell the NBA that they were going to do it, I thought was really strong because, you know, the NBA, to get these guys to come back in, is, okay, you guys can kneel. You know, we'll waive that. You can kneel. You can put stuff on the back of your jerseys. My thing is that when people give you permission to protest, is it really protest?
Right.
So I think that this was kind of – they didn't tell the NBA. In fact, I don't think George Hill told the rest of the teammates that they were going to do this. So it was fresh. It was improvisational. You know, I like that. And one thing I have, Zach, you know, I've you know, it's easy to tell people to walk out and to protest and leave, when in fact, you know, there's a lot of money on the line. There are guys who need the dough. Not need it, but like you and I need the dough. You know, if somebody came to any of us, say, hey, man, you know, Disney is doing so, let's walk.
Well, no, there are guys who need the dough. I mean, people don't know these guys' financial situations, how many people they're supporting. Not everyone is making $20 million a year in the NBA. Some people are making one, and they're paying half of it to taxes and half of it here. It's not infinite amounts of money.
Right, right. Yeah. So, yeah. But now, I will say, maybe our discussion, I want our discussion at this point is, okay, the players have gone as far as they go. Now they need the help of these multi-billionaire owners and people running the league. That has got to be the next level of the battle, because that's who the players are up against. You know, we're doing this in the middle of the Republican convention, you know, where you talk about a lot of wealth on top of wealth. Well, in order for legislators to begin to feel some type of pressure and to feel some type of heat, they need multi-billionaire owners, and not only the NBA, but in the NFL, many of whom support the president. They need for these multi-billionaires to join the fight in a real way, not just, you know, talk, but in real ways, telling state legislatures, telling attorney generals, telling mayors, you know, telling the police union, telling the president that we will defund you. We will defund you if you don't stop this. You know, this kind of inflammatory language. We know that you're trying to get elected. We know your base, but you can't have 17-year-old white kids, you know, blowing people away, you know, because of something they think they hear you're saying. You know, you can't have racist policemen who feel emboldened to just blow people away. You know, you got to stop this. So I think that there's got to be a serious financial and economic conversation between multi-billionaires to other multi-billionaires saying, listen, you know, I know this policy, but this stuff is now getting very dangerous, where people who believe in you and who think they're hearing you say certain things feel that it's in their right to like start killing people. And so I guess that's a long-winded way of saying, man, you know, multi-billionaires have to kind of enter this ring.
It's interesting you use the phrase, that's who the players are up against. Because I've had a number of people from around the league, team employees, front office employees, say to me in the last 10 hours, you know, most of our owners, our governors are on the right side of this. What do players expect them to do? They've donated money. Like, it doesn't have to be conflict like the players are making it out to be. That's the message I'm hearing. I'm not saying I agree with it. That's the message I'm hearing. Let's take the support of owners. Let's take the governors that are on the players' side politically, that they're aligned or whatever. What are you looking for them to do? What are players, do you think, looking for them to do?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, Matt, because, I'm not in those conversations.
Yeah.
I'm not in the Hamptons. You know, I'm not in the Hamptons when these multimillionaire billionaires are having their, you know, parties and get-togethers and all that. But I do know enough to know that there are things such as leverage. You know, when you're in those rooms, they say, listen, man, you know, listen, 80% of our labor force are black men. We have to do something, whether it's your election campaign or something. I don't know what those, you know, Zach, honestly, I wish I could lay it out for you. Say, oh, this is what we have. I don't know. All I know is that whatever has not been happening is not accruing to the advantage of progress. You know, I don't know what those conversations are like. I just know that there needs to be these very wealthy people who've got a labor force, their raw material of their industry are a lot of young black men and women who feel threatened, who are crying, you know, who are feeling, you know, what the hell is happening to them? They have got to protect them, and they've got to prevail on the mayors, on the police unions to stop it. And you can legitimately ask, well, Bill, what does stop it mean? I don't know what the that mean. You know, all I know is that at these places that at least I'm not privy to, where all these kind of informal conversations, the backyard barbecues on the sprawling ranches and all this stuff, people who believe, if you believe that black lives matter, if you're a multi-billionaire and you've been saying that, you've been letting them scribble it out on your court, well, that has to translate into something more than just talk. And that, what that is, I'm sorry, I wish I could be more concrete and tell you what that means. I don't know.
I also wonder what happens when the players run into or discover or play for a governor who doesn't agree with that, who doesn't agree with them politically, who has donated X amount of money to President Trump and has stenciled Black Lives Matter on the court while holding their nose and doesn't really want to, you know, I just don't know what that looks like. And we know who some of those governors are. It's not a secret.
Who are they?
Well, the DeVos family is one.
Right, yeah, right.
You know, there are others. I mean, Peter Holt's family has donated a lot of money to their, and their coach, Greg Popovich, has been the most outspoken coach in the NBA. He's just never sort of spoken directly about who's the governor of the team. You know what I mean? That's an interesting intersection to me.
Right, so Zach, tell me what you think. What do you think that means when you're an owner who lets your players scribble Black Lives Matter on the court as you hold your nose? I mean, what the hell does that mean? Would it be more honest for the DeVos family or foe to say, listen, we don't agree with it. We're not going to let you scribble it on. And we're going to do what Reagan did to the air traffic controllers. If you persist in this, we're going to throw you guys out the league. We're going to fire you, you know, because we don't. Is honesty better? Just to say we don't believe in it, we're letting you do it, you know, because whatever. I don't know why we're letting you do it. So what do you think is?
I don't know what that's going to look. I don't know what that's going to look like, because there are circumstances where it's going to happen, and there are going to be hard conversations, and I don't know. I don't know what it's going to look like, but it's interesting because I think the players have stepped into, and it's not just in the NBA. You've mentioned college athletes before. I mean, there was a whole wave of college athletes protesting all sorts of different things in the last couple of months. Players have discovered there's no game without us. There's no game. And like, some of these governors need the money from these games. They need the money from these games to help fund losses that are ongoing in their other businesses. And so I don't think these conversations are going to stop. I don't think it's just going to go back to basketball. Everyone's going to forget about this. I don't know that we'll see strikes like this or labor stoppages like this frequently, but I think we're going to see players not dropping the conversation and not just mentioning Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery and Jacob Blake in post-game interviews, but starting to mention people within their league, people in power within sports. I think that's going to start happening.
Yeah, right. Because like you said, as we all know, man, it's all about power and control, particularly in this era where money has become the highest value. All people really will react to is power, power and pressure. You know, where are the pressure points to force change? Because people are not going to do this voluntarily, whether it's DeVos or whether it's, you know, Hart, whomever. You know, you look at the WNBA, which I think has done a remarkable job. Those women have done a remarkable job. Amen. Of like putting pressure on. So I guess that, you know, basketball players and football players, and I was just talking to some players earlier today, you know, it looks like we may have some of the same stuff happening in the NFL. You're talking about a civil war.
Well, I was going to say, everyone I've talked to about the NBA restart, college football, blah, 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 everyone has said, whether it's the virus affecting a season or whether it's racial justice issues and social justice issues sort of exploding like this, everyone always says, kind of wait and see what happens with the NFL. Or right. If this happens with the NFL, then it's Armageddon. It's just fun. The NFL is just so much bigger than everything else.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, you're exactly right. You know, this thing with the NBA is fine and it's great. But the NFL is a tremendous Mount Everest, you know, and that could be a, when I say a bloody confrontation, I mean it figuratively.
Now, and as far as I understand, too, the governorship or the ownership in the aggregate in the NFL is more conservative than it is in the NBA, too.
Oh, my God. Yeah, day and night. So that's going to be a real battle. But again, the unique thing about the businesses that the owners of the NFL run is different than any Republican private, is that your raw material is black muscle. That's totally different. Totally different. You go in your labor force that you rely on, and you've got this target audience that's basically out in the street. You know, these are the young men and women who are getting killed or whose relatives are getting killed, who are dealing with systemic injustice, who are dealing, you know. So I think to some extent, there could be some level of sympathy there saying that, you know, we just can't draw this hard line saying, you know, law and order and kill them, because our labor force, our raw material, are these young black men and women. So I'm intrigued, but you mentioned something, you know, again, these are athletes and they don't spend their waking hours plotting this stuff out. You know, you need politicians.
Maya Moore had to quit her job.
Right. Exactly.
And that was for one court case.
Yeah. So what do you do? You know, I think that you need, and I don't know if you agree with this, but, you know, back in the day, you know, sports has always been looked at, even in sports department back in the day, well, that's sports. You know, that's the toy department. And I still don't know the extent to which it's taken really seriously. I think they're taking it seriously now. I mean, you know, you look at the RNC, and I know POTUS 45 is pissed. He's probably not saying it, but the fact that this would eat in, I mean, this is leading, you know, yesterday, this is leading a lot of news sites, you know, and I'm sure he's not happy about that. So these things come in, and a lot of college presidents who didn't really take sports seriously got fired because of it, you know. So I don't know where this is going, but I think this kind of gets to a conversation about sports media. You know, I think our business is probably one of the most segregated industries on earth. And I'm not just talking about the front-facing people, but I'm talking about, you know, all the behind-the-scenes people. Mm-hmm. People will be stunned when they walk through the halls of whether it's ESPN or Fox News or even the NBA front offices, how segregated this stuff is. And so we can't look at this stuff in isolation. You know, it's the totality. We, you know, to combat what we're talking about, the systemic stuff, we need more black voices, more other voices in these towers, these ivory towers where decisions are made. to really combat this stuff. So I know that's kind of getting a little far afield, but it is related to what we're, you know, what we're talking about.
As this happened last night and today, what events from your career did you think back on? What did it remind you of? What personalities did you think back on? Did anything spring to mind?
No, because I was trying to think, because, you know, whenever you say this is the first time, you know, somebody's going to say, oh, no, it happened, you know. But I was trying to, I was really flashing back to, when did this happen before? I know 1964, for example, you mentioned that, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the players, black and white NBA players, were going to boycott the All-Star game.
And that was for a very concrete goal, right? Which is, you can already hear this narrative in the background, like, well, what do these players want? What do these players want? And people will compare it to 1964. They simply wanted a pension plan. I mean, that's the state of the league. And the Lakers owner at the time, Bob Short, barged into the locker room and through the wall, basically told Elgin Baylor and Jerry West, I'm firing you if you don't go out there and play the game. I mean, that was the state of NBA labor at the time.
Exactly. And then, you know, you realize that, you know, we can't fire these guys. you know, I mean, they realize this is our business, you know, and there was that, but I couldn't, you know, when you asked me what I thought about, I couldn't think of, you know, well, Syracuse, I mean, you know, you had players back in the, I think like 1960 or something, a group of black players, you know, wanting to, thought about not playing. And maybe, I guess, we go to the University of Missouri a few years ago when the University of Missouri players said that they threatened to not play, you know, but that's different from day of game.
Yeah.
An hour before game, coach comes and says, what's this? We're not playing. I was like, whoa, you know, what are we going to do? So it's unprecedented. Now, you asked one of your how do I feel about them playing? And, you know, I guess I kind of wrote, yeah, you know, when you think of next steps, your next step should be walk out of the bubble.
Again, you wrote that last night. That's why I asked, because your column last night seemed to be saying, let's take it all the way.
Let's take it all the way. And again, you know, it's easy for me to say.
Yeah.
Easy for me to say that, yeah, let's, you know, now LeBron, and apparently LeBron, the Clippers, they wanted to go that way. They wanted to leave, you know.
I think some of them probably did, and some of them probably sensed, we have an opportunity here that if we really do want, if we are really willing to step out and we tell the governors that, and we mean it, I think we can probably extract some important, not as a sort of just calculated leverage play, but just we can actually get important things here.
And I guess I ask you, just you ask me, and I think the question is to Michelle Roberts and to Demora Smith, and that's a whole nother thing. I think that the NFLPA under Demora Smith's leadership is just so weak and so non-existent. But the question is, what does that look like when they say extract some type of something? What does it look like? You know, what does that mean? And I wish I was more of a political strategist so I could say, okay, this is what we want to extract from you. A promise to do this. You know, all I know just generally is that these police unions are off the hook and really powerful. And it's almost as if these shootings are almost in defiance, you know, of the Black Lives Matter. You know, they say, yeah, okay, well, look, take this. Bam. You know.
Is that
you
how it feels watching it?
That's how it feels to me, that not just them, but just throughout the people are saying, okay, you know, and remember, Zach, you know, I mean, and I guess the players have to be reminded of this too. There are consequences. You know, you asked me about sacrifice. Well, that's what they call a sacrifice, because there are consequences. There were consequences to Tommy Smith and John Carlson. There are consequences to Ali. There's consequences to Kaepernick. You know, tomorrow is the celebration of the March on Washington, you know, which was in August of 1963. Well, you know, there was this 200,000 people descending on Washington. There was a great speech by Dr. King and all this stuff. And guess what? The next month in Birmingham, there was a bomb blast that went off to kill four little girls at the 16th Street Baptist Church. So the Klan was saying, yeah, that's fine. We'll take this. You know, here are consequences. You know, for that, you know, we're going to, you know, the president was assassinated 3 months later, Dr. King was assassinated. So there's this ongoing battle, So just, you know, you do one thing, it's like, okay, well, we're going to do something else. And what is your commitment to this battle? Are you going to be on the right side of this, what we consider the right side, or the other side? You know, what was a 17-year-old white kid thinking who blew, you know, who murdered somebody? What was that kid in South Carolina thinking when he gunned down black parishioners at a church service and then was part of this white supremacist thing? I mean, that's real. There are people there who are looking at what we're talking about, marches and all that, and thinking, no, you know, no, I'm not down with that. And I'm going to show you I'm not down with it. I'm going to take your life. You know, I'm going to do this. So, you know, I guess my point, if there's a point, is that how committed are you to the struggle? And this struggle is like an eternal relay race. You know, it's an eternal relay race. My mentor, Sam Lacy, you know, did this until he wrote his last column, you know, when he was like 100 years old. And my role is to run as hard like a rubber, you know. So this is, we're involved in an eternal race. This is not this moment that these guys had. That's what I'm saying. I said, well, if you want to take it all the way out, leave, but you got to take the consequences. Right. And there are consequences. So,
yeah, I've said this from the beginning. I said this during the Kyrie Irving stuff. So this is not my, it is not my place, certainly, to say you should or shouldn't do this. This is something that viscerally affects most of these players, if not all of these players. And I'm, whatever they want to do, whatever feels right to them on an individual basis. I said that about Avery Bradley not going and other players not going. That's for them to decide. And if they wanted to leave, that would be fine with me. If they want to keep playing because they view this platform as important and they view it as a way to get some concrete wins, then that's their decision too. And I'm supportive of it. This more than ever, they're showing it's their league, and they pulled a pretty strong lever yesterday.
Yeah. And just sort of in closing, but you know, you play a role too, you know, and those of us in the media play a very powerful role in this, who you have on your show, the points you make, you know, people listen to you, they're influenced by you. And so none of us are passive bystanders. You know, you I think at some point you have to make a stand, even if your stand is no stand, even if your stand is, listen, I just do, you know, I do my thing and all that. So I think that in our industry, you know, I think that the way things are going in society, in our society, into this current administration, there is no neutrality. You know, there's no neutrality. You just have to take a stand, even if your stand is, hey, listen, I'm neutral, but that's my stand. Hear you. My stand is neutrality. Or you say, hear you. I'm on the side of what I perceive to be right. You know, and that is Black Lives Matter, meaning all lives matter. Black, red, Asian, straight, gay, you know, all life is sacred, you know. So enough of that.
Well, look, I know you got to go, but your perspective is invaluable. And so I thank you for taking a little time, and stay safe. I hope your family's good and keep plugging away. Because what did you say? Sam Lacy wrote till he was 100. So you got like 30 years left. So keep plugging away.
Well, I always say, well, you know, do you want your last column to be like, I don't know, is that what you want your last act to be? Is a column. Although it's a great story.
All right. Bill Roden, thank you very much. It's great to talk to you. Be well.
Thank you, Zach. You're the best.